From the BBC's World Service, this is Brian Empringham with Newsdesk. The headlines at 10 hours GMT, the UN Secretary-General, who's in Nigeria, is meeting the new military leader today as international demands grow for a return to democracy. Scientists say French nuclear tests in the South Pacific caused some contamination, but posed no threat to human health. A former film star, Joseph Estrada, has been sworn in as the new president of the Philippines. A ceremony is being held today in Germany to mark the launch of the new European Central Bank. Also in this news desk, low-key celebrations in Hong Kong on the first anniversary of its return to Chinese rule. And it's confirmed that the remains of an unknown soldier in the United States are those of a pilot shot down in the Vietnam War. The military government in Nigeria is holding talks with the most senior officials of both the United Nations and the Commonwealth as fresh efforts begin to restore democracy and end the country's international isolation. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan will meet the country's new leader, General Abdusalam Abubakar, in the capital Abuja, the first of a series of contacts with government and opposition officials. His Commonwealth counterpart, Emeka Anyaoku, will hold separate talks. It's believed that both Mr. Annan and Mr. Anyaoku will be allowed to meet the detained opposition leader, Moshood Abiola, the presumed winner of the annulled presidential election of 1993. From Abuja, Hillary Anderson reports.
Kofi Annan's visit appears to be focused on one central issue, the continued detention of Chief Abiola. The international community has been pushing for his release ever since he was detained 4 years ago by the late military leader General Sani Abacha, and now seems to be the first realistic chance of his release being secured. There are indications that both Kofi Annan and Chief Anyaoku will want to see Chief Abiola during their visits. If they do, it'll be the first time any independent visitors have been allowed to see him since last year. It's likely that by inviting high-level international visitors, the government is trying to get foreign backing for releasing Chief Abiola on the condition that he does not come out of detention and claim that he is Nigeria's rightfully elected president. The international community already seems to be behind the idea that the 1993 elections are now a thing of the past. But the key question is what Chief Abiola's own views on the subject are. After 4 years in detention, much of it spent in solitary confinement, he may not be as easy to persuade as the Nigerian government would have hoped.
That report by Hillary Anderson. Sudan's new constitution comes into effect today with a celebration marking the 9th anniversary of the coup d'etat that brought the present government to power. Officials say the document was approved by 96.7% of voters in a national referendum. Critics dismissed it as farcical. The authorities say the constitution will allow a return to party politics, but opposition figures are waiting to see how it's applied. Barbara Plett reports from Cairo.
Sudanese television showed thousands of soldiers marching in step as they paraded in front of President Omar al-Bashir. Dignitaries and ordinary citizens braved the 50-degree heat to take part in the celebration marking the government's 9th year in power. President Bashir chose the anniversary to inaugurate a new constitution that promises religious and political freedom. But the wording is vague on key points, particularly the articles guaranteeing a return to political pluralism. Opposition members are waiting to see how this translates into a law on forming political parties before they take the authority seriously. Until now, many have dismissed the constitution as a government attempt to improve its image. It's been internationally isolated because of a reputation for repressing dissent and allegedly sponsoring terrorism. The constitution automatically invalidates earlier presidential decrees that reinforced military rule, but observers say many of the country's laws would have to be changed to reflect the principles of freedom in the document. It also says the country should be governed by both tradition and Islamic law, an attempt to appease non-Muslim Sudanese. But rebels fighting a civil war in the south demand a secular state and have rejected the constitution.
Barbara Plett in Cairo. You're listening to Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC. International experts are meeting in Vienna to study a report which says that 30 years of French nuclear testing in the South Pacific have not been harmful. The report says radioactivity around the two atolls where testing took place is so low as to present no threat to human health or other living organisms nearby. France commissioned the study after international criticism of its last round of tests. From Paris, Stephen Jessel reports.
Over a 30-year period, France carried out 193 nuclear tests on and around two small atolls in the South Pacific. Of these, 46 were conducted above ground. After 1975, testing in the atmosphere was ended, and the other 147 devices were exploded underground. French testing ended with a controversial series of explosions in 1995 and 1996. And following the international uproar that followed those tests, France commissioned and paid for a $2 million study of the effects of its 30-year program. The document runs to 2,000 pages and is the work of 55 scientists from 18 countries. According to extracts already published, it finds that in general levels of radioactivity do not exceed those found in places where no nuclear explosions have been carried out, with four exceptions. Tests carried out in the atmosphere before 1975 left 8 kilograms of plutonium in the sediments of the lagoons of the two atolls, Mururoa and Fangataufa. Three small islands were also contaminated, and radioactive material is slowly leaking from underground cavities into the lagoons, creating levels of contamination 10 times higher than those found in the open sea. But the scientists say that the levels of radioactivity offer no threat to human health and are unlikely to have any effect on organisms living on or near the atolls, neither of which is inhabited. It says no corrective action is needed now or in the future. The nearest inhabited island is 130 kilometers away and is under no threat.
Reacting to the international report, Stephanie Mills from the environmental group Greenpeace said radioactive leaks from the French nuclear tests could have damaging consequences in the long term.
When you're talking about a substance like plutonium, it has a half-life of 24,000 years. A tiny little speck can cause a fatal cancer. So what we're talking about is dispersion of that plutonium, perhaps over many thousands of years, and that inevitably will contribute to a human cost and an environmental cost.
Stephanie Mills from Greenpeace, and before that we heard from our correspondent in Paris, Stephen Jessel. A former film actor, Joseph Estrada, who's been sworn in as the 13th president of the Philippines, has devoted his inaugural address to renew a campaign promise to tackle poverty and crime. Mr. Estrada, who's 61, won a landslide election victory in May. His inauguration took place in a church in Manila on the 100th anniversary of Philippines independence. John McLean in Manila sent this report.
As a former film star, Joseph Estrada is more accustomed to a movie set than a church. But now he's begun what he calls the last and greatest performance of his life by taking his oath of office as President of the Philippines. The applause, along with the singing, dancing, parades and fireworks laid on to celebrate his inauguration, might be premature. There's skepticism about Mr. Estrada's ability to keep the main promise he made to the voters who elected him last month. His promise to give a greater share of the Philippines' growing prosperity to the poor, who comprise a third of the population. It's a pledge he repeated in his inaugural address, telling a huge crowd in his usual man-of-the-people style that progress must not be measured by the number of golf courses for the rich. He also promised to stamp out crime and corruption, both in the streets and in the corridors of power. Mr. Estrada is immensely popular, for now, and he inherits a relatively healthy economy from the outgoing president, Fidel Ramos. But the Philippines is not immune from the Asian economic crisis, and that might yet hamper this actor president's ability to act.
John McLean reporting from Manila. Military officials in the Philippines say a group armed with mortars and assault rifles, believed to be Muslim guerrillas, attacked a provincial capital in the south of the country. Unconfirmed reports say that at least five people were killed in the assault on the town of Jolo. A military spokesman blamed the attack on members of the separatist Moro National Liberation Front. Three European Union ambassadors to Indonesia have cut short a fact-finding mission to East Timor. The three departed half a day early after Indonesian security agents accompanying them shot a man dead in a confrontation with pro-independence demonstrators. Before the EU delegates left, they'd cancelled a planned dinner with the governor of East Timor, Abilio Suarez. Since the new Indonesian president, B.J. Habibie, offered earlier this month to grant special status to the former Portuguese colony, which Indonesia invaded in 1975 and then annexed, there have been regular demonstrations against Indonesian rule. The Chinese president Jiang Zemin has arrived in Hong Kong to take part in ceremonies marking the first anniversary of its transfer from British rule. He'll be the guest of honor at a series of events, including the official opening of Hong Kong's new airport. But the celebrations are expected to be modest in scale because of public concern about economic recession and high unemployment. Jill McGivering reports from Hong Kong.
President Jiang arrived in Hong Kong on Tuesday accompanied by Chief Executive Tung Chee Hwa and was greeted by Hong Kong's top government officials. This is his first visit to the territory since the handover ceremonies 1 year ago. On Wednesday, he'll be the guest of honour at a cultural show and, in the evening, a formal banquet. On Thursday, he'll officiate at a ceremony to mark the opening of Hong Kong's new international airport at Chek Lap Kok, one of the most ambitious engineering projects in the world. President Jiang's arrival has been overshadowed in the local press by President Clinton's historic trip to the mainland, which has dominated the news in recent days. President Clinton will also make a brief visit to Hong Kong later this week, becoming the first person to fly into the new airport just hours after the opening ceremony. Despite the presence of such important guests, Hong Kong is in subdued mood as it marks the end of its first year as part of China. Opinion polls suggest most local people are more confident now than a year ago about the preservation of political freedoms in Hong Kong. But they're far more pessimistic about the economy. Unemployment is at its highest level for 15 years, and many people are suffering personal hardship as a result of the severe economic downturn.
Jill McGivering in Hong Kong. A ceremony is being held today in the German city of Frankfurt to launch the new European Central Bank. The bank will set interest rates in the 11 countries that are joining the European single currency when it starts in January. Our business correspondent Andrew Walker looks at the challenges facing the bank.
The European Central Bank will be one of the most influential institutions in international finance. If it can establish a reputation for being tough on inflation, the single currency, the euro, will almost certainly join the US dollar as one of the favoured currencies for the foreign exchange reserves of central banks around the world. But the European Bank will face some difficult challenges as it tries to establish its credibility in the financial markets. It will be responsible for monetary policy in 11 countries that are in strikingly different economic condition. Some, like Ireland and Finland, are growing very strongly. The heavyweights of the group, France and Germany, are much more sluggish. Getting the right interest rates for all will be almost impossible. The head of the bank, the Dutchman Wim Duisenberg, has already said that rates are likely to be low at first, which is more appropriate for France and Germany. Other countries may have to use other policies to ward off any inflationary risk arising from their strong growth. In one respect, the bank got off to an unfortunate start. The appointment of Mr. Duisenberg at an EU summit in May became a political controversy as France sought to have its own candidate chosen instead. The row raised questions in the minds of the financial markets about whether the bank will be subject to political interference.
Andrew Walker. The World Bank has launched a $40 million trust fund to help Asian countries cope with rising unemployment and poverty. The fund is designed to offer advice and technical assistance so that countries affected by the regional economic crisis can restructure their financial sectors and deal with growing social problems. Seven nations are so far eligible to receive benefits: China, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, South Korea, Thailand, and Vietnam. And in Japan, unemployment rose to record levels last month. According to latest government figures, almost 500,000 more Japanese are now out of work compared to a year ago. With more on this and the latest from the markets, here's Mike Johnson.
The number of jobless in Japan now stands at 2.93 million, the highest since the government began using its present method of calculation in 1953. While the rate of unemployment at 4.1% was unchanged in May compared to April, Japan remains in the grip of economic recession. Many companies have gone bankrupt, with manufacturing and construction particularly hard hit. Japanese workers are no longer guaranteed the job security they once took for granted, and the number of less stable part-time posts is increasing at the expense of full-time work. But despite the economic gloom, shares in Japan rose strongly. That was due to Prime Minister Ryotaro Hashimoto's efforts to speed the introduction of a scheme where failing banks would be taken over by the state to guarantee loans to low-risk borrowers. The Nikkei ended up 464 at 15,830. But London's 100 index is now down 28 at 58.56. Currencies, and the dollar is worth 139.9 yen and 1 mark 80.9. Finally, the pound is at $1.66.6.
Mike Johnson. You're tuned to News Desk from the BBC in London. Time now for a reminder of today's top headline. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who's in Nigeria, is meeting the new military leader, Abdusalam Abubakar, today as international demands grow for a return to democracy. And still to come in the programme, how President Clinton, continuing his visit to China, finally discovered football. A representative of the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency is holding talks in Baghdad with Iraqi officials on outstanding questions related to Iraq's nuclear weapons program. The outcome could lead to a decision from the United Nations Security Council to close the file on Iraq's past nuclear weapons activity. But the talks come against the background of new evidence by UN weapons inspectors that Iraq produced missiles filled with the deadly nerve agent VX. An allegation Baghdad denies. From Baghdad, Nick Childs reports.
The 4 days of talks this week in Baghdad will clearly have an important influence on the debate due in the UN Security Council next month on whether or not to wrap up the nuclear inspections process in Iraq. There's been growing pressure on the Security Council to agree to switch to a less intrusive form of long-term monitoring of Iraq's nuclear activities after the IAEA reported that it had had satisfactory answers from Baghdad on its past weapons program. That would remove an important obstacle to lifting UN sanctions. This week's talks are meant to deal with a number of outstanding issues, including where Iraq got some of its sensitive nuclear equipment from in the past. The IAEA says these issues are not critical or central to its investigations. Iraq's friends on the Security Council agree, but others do not. And whereas it had been thought the United States might not stand in the way of, in effect, closing the nuclear file, that may have changed in the light of the renewed air of mistrust engendered by the row over VX nerve agent. Whether or not Iraq is any more forthcoming this week could have an important bearing not only on the nuclear file, but also on the whole question of weapons inspections and sanctions. So too will talks due in mid-July on both chemical and biological weapons. On all these fronts, Iraq continues to insist it has no more information to offer.
Nick Childs in Baghdad. The Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi is due in Tehran today on one of the most important visits to Iran by a head of a Western government since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Italian officials say Mr. Prodi's talks with Iranian leaders, including President Khatami, will focus on political issues. His visit comes as attempts by the European Union to revive comprehensive talks with Iran have become deadlocked. The EU froze its dialogue with Tehran last year following a court case which linked the authorities in Tehran to a political assassination in Berlin. But European Union diplomats insist that Mr. Prodi is representing Italy alone. This report from Pam O'Toole.
Both Iran and Italy are stressing the historic nature of Mr. Prodi's visit. European diplomats say it's strictly bilateral and he's not charged with negotiating a resumption of talks between the European Union and Tehran. Nevertheless, the visit's being seen as a symbol that Europe believes Iran, under its new reformist president, Mohammad Khatami, is finally coming in from the cold. Italy has been in the forefront of efforts to improve relations between the EU and Tehran. Iranian ministers have praised Italian policies towards Tehran as the most positive and pragmatic in Europe. Italy's also one of Iran's biggest trading partners, and the Iranian press is speculating that this visit could lead to even closer economic links. However, Italy insists Mr. Prodi's agenda is political rather than economic. Italian officials say he'll concentrate on Iran-EU relations and three contentious issues which traditionally feature in talks between Tehran and Europe: Iran's position on the Middle East peace process and allegations about its support for terrorism and secret weapons program. On Sunday, Iranian state radio called on the European Union to stop raising international terrorism and human rights, saying it did nothing to improve relations. Western diplomats dismiss this as posturing, saying Tehran is well aware of the importance of such issues. However, analysts say the EU is also keen to enter a new phase in which it would engage Tehran in a broader international dialogue.
Pam O'Toole. The United States has urged the United Nations Security Council not to take action over Israel's decision to extend the administrative boundaries of Jerusalem. The Council is due to debate the issue later today at the request of Arab countries. But a State Department spokesman said any action by the Council would be counterproductive. The expansion plan would increase the Jewish population of Jerusalem by 30,000. It's caused outrage among Arabs and the Israeli opposition, who say it contravenes peace accords. Fighting in the Serbian province of Kosovo has gone into a second consecutive day around the mining town of Belachevac, as Serbian forces continue their offensive to retake the town from the ethnic Albanian separatist group, the Kosovo Liberation Army. The sound of explosions was reported shortly after dawn. Thousands of residents are now reported to have fled. With concern that the fighting could trigger a regional war, the Prime Minister of the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, Branko Crvenkovski, has been discussing the Kosovo conflict with United States officials in Washington. He said a political solution still seemed to be the aim. A papal special envoy who's on a visit to Cuba has told Roman Catholics there that they should demand from the state the right to choose how to educate their children. Cardinal Pio Laggi, who heads the Catholic Commission on Education, was speaking during a mass in Havana's cathedral. Tom Gibb in Havana sent this report.
Cardinal Pio Laggi presided over a mass in Havana's cathedral to celebrate the festival of St. Peter and St. Paul. The congregation burst into applause when he told them that it's their duty to demand from the state the right to choose the style of teaching they want for their children. It's long been a central aim of the Church to break the communist monopoly over education. Religious teaching should not, said the Cardinal, contradict the lay character of the modern state. Cuban government officials responsible for religious affairs were in the front row at the mass, but so far there's little sign of them allowing the Church to set up its own schools or colleges. In the absence of such concessions, the Church is opting for a strategy of negotiation and dialogue with the government. Church leaders want to slowly expand their base of support rather than looking for a confrontation with the government, which they probably lose. Apart from greater religious education, the church would also like access to television and radio, which until now has been strictly controlled by the government.
Tom Gibb in Havana. Remains exhumed from the Tomb of the Unknowns in the United States have been identified as those of an Air Force pilot shot down during the Vietnam War. The tomb contains the remains of unidentified servicemen from several conflicts. The Defense Department had agreed to new forensic tests in response to pressure from the family of the airman. Our correspondent Richard Lister reports from Washington.
Michael Blassie was shot down over Vietnam on May the 11th, 1972, but when his remains were found many years later, it was impossible to conclusively identify them. They were interred alongside those of other fallen servicemen and women at Arlington National Cemetery in 1984. But his family felt there was enough circumstantial evidence at the crash site, including identification tags and a parachute, to indicate that the body was his, even though other evidence failed to back it up. They've been pressing the Defense Department to reopen the case ever since. Last month, the Defense Secretary, William Cohen, agreed that there were grounds to believe that the body may have been that of one of two servicemen. In an unprecedented decision, he ordered the tomb to be unlocked, and the remains were removed for DNA tests, which had not been available when the body was first discovered. Those tests have now confirmed the Blassie family's suspicions, and they're waiting to give the former pilot a last farewell at a marked burial site, 26 years after his final mission.
Richard Lister in Washington. You're listening to Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC. It's now 24 minutes past 10 GMT, and now sport. And there's plenty of action at the Wimbledon Tennis Championships today, rain permitting, that is, and at football's World Cup. The two remaining quarterfinal places will be decided. With more details, here's Gordon Eastwood.
Yes, play is already underway at Wimbledon, with the action on the show courts due to start in an hour. Pete Sampras continues the defence of his men's singles title, and there are plenty of other fourth-round matches still to be played. Here's Andy Farrant at the All England Club.
Well, the Sun has apparently bought a ticket for today's play, and we're away on time. One of those fourth-round matches has the defending women's champion Martina Hingis against Thailand's Tamarin Tanasugarn. Here's Martina's assessment of her opponent.
Tanasugarn is, she's one of the ones I've played before, like very flat, but she doesn't have a great serve, or you always can get into the game with her. But she has a fast game, so we'll see.
The winner will play either Sanchez Vicario or Van Roost in the last eight. Like Hingis, the defending men's champion, Pete Sampras, hasn't dropped a set so far in these championships. He plays the unseeded Frenchman, Sebastian Grosjean, for a place in the quarterfinals.
At football's World Cup, much of the attention centres on today's match in Saint-Étienne between England and Argentina. But that's not the only game of the day. Croatia and Romania meet in Bordeaux for the right to play Germany in the quarterfinals. The Croatian coach Miroslav Blajevic says he'll drop his star midfielder Robert Prosinecki because he's showing signs of tiredness. That might be just a ploy, but one thing is certain, the introduction of Igor Stimac to the role of sweeper, and that's a move he's more than happy with.
I was waiting on this occasion quite a lot. Never had a chance to play a sweeper for national team, and I'm playing this place in my ex-clubs for the last 7 years. It was very difficult for me to come for and play for national team, different position.
It looks like it's going to be a very technical game.
I'm not sure about it. It depends on the weather. I hope it's going to rain.
It's very
because hot. We need some fresh weather so we can run well.
So you'd prefer it if the game was played at a faster pace,
yes,
more frantic?
Yes. As you can see, when it's so warm, pitch is stopping the ball and you cannot control it very well.
And the Romanian coach Angel Iordanescu is hopeful that Dan Petrescu and Adrian Ili will both recover from injury in time to start the game.
Gordon Eastwood. And football was one of the subjects taken up by President Clinton during a live radio phone-in in Shanghai as he continues his visit to China. He hailed the possibilities of football diplomacy to help bring about a thaw in relations between the United States and Iran following the recent World Cup match between the two. Mr. Clinton said the World Cup was a great way of bringing people together. Bridget Kendall reports from Shanghai.
Mr. Clinton's comments on the World Cup came in response to a Shanghai student who called the radio station wanting to know his sporting preferences. The president said, though golf was his personal favourite, the World Cup was becoming more and more important to Americans. And while the recent match between the US and Iran had been heartbreaking for Americans because they hadn't expected to lose, it had shown it was a great way of bringing people together. So when he was asked if, like the ping-pong diplomacy that once cracked the ice between the US and China, it was now time for football diplomacy, he was enthusiastic.
I think Americans were riveted by the soccer game. And they were impressed because we were supposed to win the game and we had lots of chances. But the Iranians had two fast breaks and they played with such passion and they had those two chances and they capitalized on both of them. And we respect that.
Iran, he added, had already treated the American wrestling team that visited Tehran with great respect. And the new president of Iran seemed committed to moving towards better relations with the rest of the world, so he hoped something more would come of it. There have already been other indications from Mr. Clinton's administration he wants to improve relations with Tehran. A recent speech by his Secretary of State said quite explicitly the United States wants to explore further ways to build mutual confidence with Iran and avoid misunderstandings.
Bridget Kendall. And the day's main stories again, the most senior officials of the United Nations and the Commonwealth are in Nigeria for talks with the country's new military leader, General Abdusalam Abubakar. There's increasing speculation that the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, will meet the detained opposition leader, Moshood Abiola. International experts are meeting in Vienna to study a report which says that 30 years of French nuclear testing in the South Pacific have not been harmful. However, the International Atomic Energy Agency said the findings did not mean that nuclear testing in general was safe. A former film actor in the Philippines, Joseph Estrada, has been sworn in as the country's 13th president. And a ceremony is being held in the German city of Frankfurt to launch the new European Central Bank. It'll set interest rates from next January in the 11 countries launching European Monetary Union. That's the latest. This is Brian Empringham, and you've been listening to Newsdesk.